My guest today, Patrick Woodall, is Research Director and Senior Policy Advocate for Food and Water Watch. Patrick has been a public policy analyst, researcher, and advocate on economic justice issues in Washington for more than two decades. He is a co-author of a book on the World Trade Organization and has written dozens of reports and articles on public policy. He received a BA from Johns Hopkins with concentrations in international relations and economics, and he has been closely following the administration's effort to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which has seen President Obama openly turn his back on the people who twice elected him to office while standing shoulder to shoulder with the Republicans, whose loyalty to corporate interests is impeccable and who have savaged the president on every other issue. With that introduction, welcome Patrick Woodall to Takes on the World.
It's great to be here today.
Tell our listeners about Food and Water Watch and what it does and what its role has been.
Food and Water Watch is a national advocacy group that works on ensuring that food, water, and natural resources are available and affordable for all Americans. And we have been working with a broad-based coalition of labor, environmental, public health, internet freedom, and other advocates across the country to kind of stop this corporate trade agenda that is currently before the Congress. And so we've been doing this largely because the issues that we care about domestically, things like food safety, water, municipal water systems, and things like that, sensible food labels, are really at risk with the international trade deals that put commercial interests ahead of the public interest.
Now, it's interesting that this deal has been kept absolutely secret from the American public, apart from what WikiLeaks has leaked out. And members of Congress can go in and see it, but can't even take their cell phones or take notes. But evidently, we have the corporations have had no problem knowing it, and they helped to write it.
It is curious. I mean, this is probably the most secret trade deal in history, and although the Obama administration has pretended to be very transparent, in this instance particularly, they have been anything but. It's not just that the Congress can't take notes or take their staff or bring their cell phones. Up until April, really, they had an even higher burden than that. They had to go across town and request a meeting in order to examine a text that's been under negotiation for 6 or 7 years. It's important to consider that the Bush administration actually released the negotiating text of the Free Trade Area of the Americas on the Internet, so everybody could look at it while it was under negotiation. And their justification for that was, look, we believe that there are benefits for these trade deals, and we want to show the people that there's good stuff in there, and that's why they did it. In contrast, the Obama administration has viewed these commercial negotiations as the same as the negotiations with Iran over atomic weapons. So, you know, you have a very different mindset, and obviously, you know, it's very easy for the administration to say this is the most progressive trade deal in history when they won't let us see it.
You know, it's interesting. When Obama came to office, he did something that President McCain would have had a hard time getting away with. That's bailing out the banks in Wall Street. And now as he presents or he prepares to leave office, he's doing the same thing with his take no prisoners pursuit of the TPP. Is it fair to portray him as something of a Trojan horse with the cigar-smoking corporate CEOs partying inside, while those who support him stand on the outside waving their placards with his picture, shouting his name, even as they throw open the doors of their citadel and let the corporations in to do their plundering? Is that a fair picture of what we're seeing? Is that a cover for the New Yorker?
I think that there's great skepticism at this point, because you have a situation where on one side, you have everybody from Wall Street to K Street, Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, the telecommunications industry, all aligned on one side, and a host of other big manufacturers, with the White House and the Republican leadership. And against them are the overwhelming number of the rank and file of not only Democrats and progressives, but also a good portion of conservatives and Republicans in opposition to these trade deals. So it does seem that although they contend it's really protecting their global legacy, really what they're doing is a total giveaway to corporate interest. And as you alluded to, I mean, there are some 600 trade advisors that are providing guidance to the ongoing negotiations. About 85% of them, according to a Washington Post analysis, were actually corporate lobbyists, business interests, and trade associations that really have, they have a lot at stake. And so they're actually in there giving guidance to the trade negotiators and inserting essentially special interest mischief right into the text of the agreement. There are some kind of public interest advisors, but they've mostly been relegated to kind of committees like the Labor Committee, where the unions are telling the administration that they're very concerned about things, and basically the U.S. Trade Representative pats the environmentalists and the labor advocates on their head and says, they're there, everything's going to be okay, but they don't really have the same sort of muscle in the negotiations that the business interests have.
Well, it seems that U.S. trade representatives, once they leave office, go to work for the corporations that they once kind of dealt with. The New York Times had a story the other day exposing the fact the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is a worldwide operation, has offices all over the world, and they have been pushing for tobacco companies or countries that want to put just plain labels and warnings on cigarettes that this is a violation of their intellectual freedom, intellectual property, and that at one point Robert Kirk, who was the trade representative for the United States, is now a senior lawyer at a firm that has a tobacco industry as a client. This seems to be the American way of business.
Well, the revolving door turns quite swiftly in Washington, but in nowhere is the velocity higher than at the U.S. Trade Representative's office. I mean, it's not just that they go to corporate America. They frequently come from corporate America as well. And so these kind of special interest giveaways are really part and parcel of these trade deals. Look, that is why they are pushing for these deals. It is because hidden in the fine print in the majority of the text of the agreement is not really about tariffs or goods crossing borders or quotas on imports. The majority of the agreement is actually about regulations and oversight. And the big business know that when they can't prevail with their lobbying muscle in Congress and they can't prevail in the executive branches with the regulatory rulemaking process, they always can hit the change of venue button and go to an international trade tribunal and actually try and overturn common sense domestic rules through these trade agreements. And that's exactly what the chamber has been doing on these public health rules on tobacco packaging. And right now there are several investment cases under international trade rules that are basically allowing the tobacco companies to challenge Australia and Uruguay's rules on tobacco labeling as unfair infringement on their intellectual property. And they're actually suing for damages because Australia is trying to ensure that they are not going to, tobacco companies can't market to kids. So that's the kind of topsy-turvy world that these trade deals kind of cause.
Well, Patrick Woodall, you put your finger on this problem in which any argument or controversy apparently goes to a board of corporation hacks or employees, I should say, who will then decide whether a country is in violation of the intellectual property or the business freedom, free trade rights of a corporation, and the public has no one sitting at the table.
That's absolutely right. So these trade tribunals under the World Trade Organization, under the North American Free Trade Agreement and others are essentially composed of corporate trade lawyers. Sometimes they're the plaintiffs, they represent the tobacco interest or whoever at the at these international trade tribunals. Sometimes they're the judges, right? And so when you have that kind of obvious conflict of interest, it's, you know, they tend to rule in favor of the corporations that are making the challenges or the countries that are bringing a challenge that based on a corporate complaint, and they are very favorable to those. Most of the plaintiffs win in these trade tribunals, and as a consequence, obviously, the tribunalists have an incentive to do that because they want to be hired as the corporate litigator in the next suit down the line. So it has a real disincentive to actually putting the public interest safeguards in the level that they deserve. But ultimately, the notion of these trade agreements has just a structural problem with it, where it says that the penultimate goal is to encourage international commercial interests, that you must put trade before all other interests. So even if you were to have a public interest protection that was very sensible, it has to be done in a way that is least trade restrictive. And ultimately, that means it's almost impossible to have protections that are strong enough for the public, but yet don't infringe at all on any international commerce. I mean, this spring, the World Trade Organization ruled again against the U.S. Labeling rules that provide country of origin information for beef and for pork. And the WTO ruled that our common sense labels that tell Americans where their food comes from constituted an illegal trade barrier. Now, think about it. This is a situation where we just have a label that says born, raised, and slaughtered in America, or born in Canada, raised, and slaughtered in the United States, and that is an illegal trade barrier. And the Congress responded almost immediately, the House of Representatives, by repealing the statute. So we have a situation where there is an incredibly popular law. So 95% of Americans support knowing where their beef and pork comes from. Farmers and ranchers across the country overwhelmingly support these labels. Canada was outraged by them and brought a WTO suit, and this process has been going on, but it's not finished. But after the latest ruling, the House of Representatives repealed the statute. So that's really what's at stake. Even pretty straightforward, simple rules like this that provide transparency. It's not that the imports of cattle were prohibited from Canada. It just let Americans know where the food they were eating came from, and that is viewed as an illegitimate trade barrier.
And the American public doesn't know about this because you don't hear about it, whether it's Fox News or MSNBC or NPR. You'll find it in the financial sections of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, but this is the kind of information that is more important to the public than who's getting married and who's giving birth and the stories that they make appealing to the public, but this is what affects their lives. It's an extraordinary situation, and it obviously didn't begin under the Obama administration.
No, and these are literally kitchen table issues. These are issues that affect families every time they go to the supermarket, and in terms of food labeling, but also in terms of some important food safety issues as well. And so people care pretty deeply about these, and ultimately this whole process started to change in the Bush 1 Clinton administration with the North American Free Trade Agreement and the World Trade Organization, where the kind of transformation of trade agreements from not just being about taxes on imports or limitations on imports and exports of goods, but instead started to have really intrusive reach into domestic policy because the U.S. had very, very low tariffs and import barriers, and what the companies really wanted was to actually be able to use these trade agreements as a way to unravel common sense protections and safeguards that had been built up by the Congress at the will of the American people.
You know, this morning I printed out the U.S. Trade Representative's website presentation of the TPP, headline, Unlocking Opportunity for Americans Through Trade with Asia Pacific. And it's Orwellian. It's Orwellian. It begins, President Obama's trade agenda is dedicated to expanding economic opportunity for American workers, farmers, ranchers, and businesses. That's why we're negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 21st century trade agreement that will boost U.S. economic growth, support American jobs, and grow Made in America exports to some of the most dynamic and fastest growing countries in the world. And we see that there was a piece of legislation, I don't know what status now, that was going to retrain American workers whose jobs would be lost through the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's kind of like you go through this statement, and it's something that one would have expected from the Soviet Union, but it is just outright propaganda, which is there for any American who might be curious to see with nothing to respond to it.
They have been engaged in an aggressive public relations campaign, and the reason is because the public is legitimately skeptical of the benefits of these trade deals, and that's because of their experience over the last 25 years of trade deals with NAFTA, with China, with a host of other countries, with the World Trade Organization, all of which have put incredible pressure and downward pressure on U.S. wages, on U.S. jobs, on U.S. on opportunity for workers in America. And so they know that this is something that affects their daily lives. And they also, we've seen more and more cases where things like the country of origin labeling, like the kind of constant erosion of the dolphin-safe tuna, which has been going on for the past two decades. They understand that some of these trade deals have effects well beyond shuttering of factories and offshoring of U.S. jobs. Ultimately, the kind of corporate-led globalization has been a contributing factor of the economic inequality in America, the widening gulf between a tiny number of very, very well-off haves and a growing number of less well-off have-nots. And a large part of that is because of the kind of corporate-driven globalization that puts the value of international commerce in the hands of a tiny number of super investors and not in the hands of the workers producing the goods that are shipped around the world. So there's a reason for their incredible aggressive PR campaign, and that is to try and overcome the skepticism of the American public. They know that the public thinks this is a raw deal, and they're trying to make it sound like it's a good deal. Look, the very existence, the fact that Congress passes a law that retrains workers that lose their jobs because of trade deals proves that Congress knows that these are job-killing deals.
It's extraordinary that they really are saying total contempt of Congress, and the president is showing total contempt for his base, even insulting those who are more economically astute than he is, such as Elizabeth Warren. Here's another one from our government. The TPP will promote strong environmental protection. Environmental protection is a core American value. Through the TPP, the United States is negotiating for robust environment standards and commitments from member countries and addressing some of the region's most pressing environmental challenges. Now, how would you respond to that?
Well, actually, this is a pretty important point because we believe that the TPP will actually be worse on the environment than the Bush agreement with Peru. So it actually is a step backwards on environmental issues within trade deals. The Bush administration and the Congress reached an accord in 2010 that basically said that trade agreements should include ensuring that our partner countries uphold their own labor and environmental laws and ensure that workers have the right to bargain collectively for independent unions. And that was designed to ensure that countries upheld their own laws, and they didn't allow the flaunting of their own environmental or labor laws to become essentially a competitive disadvantage for those companies. So a company could move to a trade partner country and then not obey their environmental laws or not obey their labor laws and have an advantage by being able to ship things to the U.S. at artificially low prices. And so we have that in place in the Peru trade agreement. Now, interestingly, the Obama administration has not used the enforcement mechanism of the Peru trade agreement to ensure that Peru is actually upholding its own environmental laws, even though there's some flagrant examples of violations there. But the TPP does not include these kind of provisions, right? So what you want is something that has not only requires countries to uphold their own laws, pretty sensible, common sense, nothing crazy about that, but also to enable countries to bring challenges akin to the kind of the commercial challenges that are brought under trade deals for countries that turn a blind eye to flagrant environmental and labor abuses. And so that's what the Peru deal is supposed to do, that it's in place now. The Obama administration really hasn't been using those provisions to make sure that Peru doesn't violate its own environmental and labor laws, and that's what they should have been doing, but they haven't. And the TPP doesn't include these provisions, so it's actually a step backwards on environmental protections. Most of the pieces that are in the TPP, the draft that we've seen, really relate to international conservation agreements, things like the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which is a wildlife and trafficking agreement. And basically, the provisions urge the countries to uphold these conventions, but they are the language in the text that WikiLeaks released actually is fairly weak and doesn't have the same sort of enforcement and binding measures that you see in things like intellectual property or investment chapters that have been released. They are more aspirational than rigorously enforceable.
We're not talking about a small section of the world economy. As I understand it, this deal will affect 40%, potentially 40% of the world's economy. Is that correct?
It is correct. So it's a 12-nation pact that includes the U.S., Canada, Mexico, Peru, Chile, New Zealand, Australia, Malaysia, Brunei, Singapore, and Japan. So it's a big deal. It covers a lot of ground. But remember, these are not equal partners, right? A wide range of economic development between the U.S. and Vietnam or Peru. And so these countries, when they negotiate, really are at a somewhat disadvantage that in exchange for being part of a free trade agreement with America, they have to kind of basically surrender some of their ability to take positions that they would care about. Some obvious ones are areas on intellectual property over pharmaceuticals for essential medicines, where developing countries have an interest in ensuring that they get access to generic medicines for things like TB and malaria and HIV as early as possible. But obviously, the pharmaceutical industry would rather extend the life of patents so that they can maximize their profits. And some of the language in the intellectual property chapter of the TPP essentially would extend patent life, extend control over data, and ultimately make it harder for generic drugs to get onto the market. In the U.S., that means that Americans are going to face higher pharmaceutical prices. In the developing world, this is a situation where many people in need will lack essential medicines that could save their lives.
I should remind the listeners, it wasn't well publicized, But in the negotiations or before the actual voting on President Obama's Affordable Care Act, he consulted the pharmaceutical companies, the same pharmaceutical companies, to allow them to essentially write the passages for the Affordable Care Act that went into the Affordable Care Act, the Affordable Care Act being a gift not only for the pharmaceutical companies, but for the insurance companies. And I would suggest that that is one of the reasons that the Supreme Court did not overturn the Affordable Care Act. It's just a little aside, but I noticed the pharmaceutical companies have a major role in this TPP, as you mentioned, that this is going to really deny access to life-saving pharmaceuticals from people all over the world. And the U.S. government has also contributed a great deal of money in the development of these pharmaceuticals. Is that not right?
I'm not an expert on the U.S. investment in pharmaceutical research, but my sense is that's right.
What is the status at the moment of the TPP? It still has. What was passed was the fast track, so to speak. Now President Obama knows that no amendments can be made to the bills. So, what's the status at the moment of TPP?
Right. So last month, the Congress finally, after a really bitter struggle, passed the Fast-Track Trade Promotion Authority. And that essentially lets the president negotiate, choose the partners, set the terms of the trade agreements, and then submit the trade agreement to the Congress for an up or down, take it or leave it vote. And that passed very narrowly by a single vote in the Senate, by a tiny handful of votes in the House. And the president signed it. And so now they are going to finalize the negotiation of the TPP. There is meetings are scheduled in late this month in Hawaii with the negotiators and then the trade ministers of each country. And then ultimately they will come to some sort of conclusion, and then the president will submit the agreement to Congress, but he will also submit something known as an implementing act that will include any changes to U.S. law or to U.S. regulatory regimes or to U.S. oversight that would need to be made in order to bring the U.S. statutes into compliance with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So both those things would be submitted to Congress, and then Congress would have to vote on them within 60 days of them being submitted.
So we will have Republicans who talk so much about U.S. sovereignty submitting U.S. sovereignty to the TPP.
That is true. For those Republicans that support the TPP, they will be subjugating U.S. laws to international faceless bureaucrats and U.N. tribunalists who will be able to rule on U.S. statutes and U.S. laws and regulations and safeguards, all of that, as is the case with all the other trade agreements. A large portion of the Republican Party and the conservative base are adamantly opposed to these trade deals for this exact reason, that they oppose having a foreign power being able to make judgments over U.S. laws and that are unappealable, that have no part of the U.S. court system. There's no oversight domestically on these rulings. And so as a consequence, there are many in the Republican Party who are opposed to these trade agreements because of that exact fact.
So what kind of a mobilization is being made? I know the AFL-CIO is finally flexing its muscles or trying. It let many Democrats who supported NAFTA, such as Nancy Pelosi, off the hook. Nancy Pelosi, it's interesting, has responded this time opposing the TPP. But how big is the coalition that's mobilizing against it?
Well, I think it's quite broad-based and quite large. Obviously, the House of Labor has been very very engaged and united on this issue. So the entirety of the American labor movement opposed Fast Track, and that is really helped, but it's not just the labor movement. It is a broad-based coalition of consumer, environmental, public health, internet freedom, faith-based farm group opposition to these trade deals that is already in place, and they've been working tirelessly first to try and stop Fast Track, which they almost succeeded in, and much to the surprise of the corporate interests and the White House lobbying machine. And now I think they're going to turn their attention to trying to defeat TPP when it comes up. So there's and obviously there's a similar movement amongst the conservatives, and many of the Tea Party activists are opposed to this. Many Tea Party groups are opposed. Heritage Action opposed Fast Track and may be skeptical of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So there is a growing grassroots movement that is already in place, that is only getting stronger, that is highly skeptical of these trade deals and will insist upon holding members of Congress accountable. I believe that already there are people that are being recruited to run in opposition to in primary opponents for some of the Democrats who voted for Fast Track. And Leader Pelosi was just fantastic in this Fast Track fight. She highlighted why it was time for we needed a new kind of trade agreement, a new kind of trade policy agenda that put workers and the environment and consumer protection ahead of the commercial interests. And they unified opposition to this amongst the Democrats in both the House and the Senate. Again, this is they've only narrowly passed this kind of arcane procedural measure. It's not even a trade deal itself. It's a measure to consider future trade deals. So it's almost a meta trade policy law. So it's a little tricky to get people engaged in this kind of statute, but obviously the opposition to TPP is broad and deep, and it will continue to pressure the Congress to actually obey the will of the American people and stand up to these kind of corporate interests that are running roughshod over so many working Americans' lives.
Well, Pelosi was my former congresswoman for a number of years, and I was happy to see her take this position. I remember at the time of NAFTA, she spoke to the San Francisco Labor Council, which I attended a meeting, and after praising NAFTA, one tall member got up, and I can't repeat on the air the word he said to Pelosi, it's BS and you know it. And I think this time, the Labor Council, which has supported her faithfully for years, this time made the demands upon her that this was kind of the last straw. This had to be opposed. I think the pressure of labor was very important in her making that decision, going against the president.
I think the breadth of the other opposition, right? So, look, you know, Brunei is a country that has Sharia law that targets gays and lesbians. Vietnam is a country that uses child labor. Malaysia is a known harbor of sex traffickers, right? There's a host of good reasons to be opposed to this. The food safety issues are important. The public health issues on pharmaceuticals are important. The issues related to internet freedom and net neutrality, which could be overturned by this trade deal, are important. All of those come into play. Look, in 94... almost half of California Democrats supported NAFTA. Only less than 15% of California Democrats supported Fast Track last month. So it's a sea change. And remember, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the exports are going to go out through California ports. They're going to go out through the Port of Oakland, and they're going to come in through the Port of San Pedro. You know, there's a lot of commercial activity benefit that's going to happen to California just because of the flow of goods, even if they all come in, even if it's mostly imports, that stuff's going to come mostly through California. But most California Democrats oppose Fast Track, and I suspect will oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well.
One last question. This doesn't seem to have been asked of any of the presidential candidates except Hillary Clinton, who's kind of waffling on it. Do you have any more information on that?
Well, I think on the Democratic side, I think Bernie Sanders has been clear on this, and he's opposed to the TPP. It sounds like Martin O'Malley is opposed to the TPP. I haven't heard from Lincoln Chafee or Jim Webb, although Jim Webb was skeptical of trade deals when he was in the Senate. On the Republican side, a few of the candidates were opposed to fast track. Notably, Ted Cruz switched his vote and voted against fast track on the second go-round in the Senate. And Mike Huckabee and I believe Donald Trump were opposed to fast track and have expressed skepticism about the trade deals generally. So I suspect, remember, you know, there's going to be a 60-day period after the president initials the deal, and then he'll submit it to Congress 60 days later, and then it'll go to, and Congress has to vote on it 60 days after that. So it's kind of 4 months from when they finalize the deal to when Congress has to vote on it. That, if they finalize this at the end of July or early August, that's late November, early December, and is pretty darn close to when the Republican primaries will really be heating up in Iowa and New Hampshire. So I suspect that there will be more attention to this issue as we go forward.
Well, Patrick Woodall, Food and Water Watch, I want to thank you very much. I suspect I'll be getting back to you as this fight goes on. Thank very, very much for bringing the information you brought to our audience today to Takes on the World, and look forward to speaking with you again. And good luck, and keep up the fight.
Thank you very much. It's been great being here.